You have just heard Professor Neil Brooks speaking at the Vancouver Public Library on November 3, 2010, about his new book, The Trouble with Billionaires, Why Too Much Money at the Top is Bad for Everyone. Next up, best-selling author and business columnist and co-author of The Trouble with Billionaires, Linda McQuaig.
Well, Neil is always a hard act to follow. But let me start by saying what a wonderful pleasure it is to be here, how absolutely honored and delighted I am by this invitation from the CCPA and the Vancouver Public Library, and just how thrilled I am to see so many of you here tonight. We actually had reserved the front row for the provincial cabinet, but there were a no-show, so that allowed us to get a little more space. But seriously, it is wonderful to see so many people here. I had a chance before we began to talk individually with some of you, and your well wishes and support were incredibly invigorating and exciting to me, particularly because I, not long ago, was in Calgary. And, that was interesting. But it is quite right-wing there, and they don't necessarily like everything about the book. But let me just say, I have figured out how to deal with these right-wingers, okay? You know, like when they come at you with some harangue, I've now learned how to do it. And here's the trick. You just stand your ground. You look them dead in the eye. And with complete conviction, you say, "Go, flames, go." It's wonderful to feel that this is a progressive audience. I have that sense from time to time. I am invited to speak to audiences that aren't so progressive, and that's always a bit of a downer. One time I was invited to speak to a business audience. That doesn't happen to me too often, but I decided to accept, and I showed up at the place, and it was a little bit different than this crowd tonight. It was a swanky club in downtown Toronto, but I got there and I was absolutely amazed because the place was packed with businessmen all dressed up in black tie and everything, and I started to feel pretty good. I thought, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe business really is interested in what I have to say, you know, hearing me tell them how they should pay more tax and all that sort of thing. But it didn't quite turn out that way. In fact, that night, it was all downhill after the introduction. The guy introduced me. It wasn't nice like what Seth said. That night, the guy introducing me said, I'd like to introduce our speaker tonight, Linda McQuaig. I'm apologizing that we have her with us tonight. And she's here with us tonight due to the cancellation of our real speaker, the man you all came to hear, Conrad Black. Now, I think you're probably expecting I'm going to go on and say some nasty things about Conrad Black, you know. And I have done that at various points in my life, but actually tonight I want to say something nice about Conrad Black. Yeah, you know, it's absolutely true that he has spent his whole life fighting against social justice. But I think he gives us hope because he's living proof that even a rich right-wing jerk can end up in jail, and that shows social justice is possible. Now, I heard some very nice things said about me tonight from Neil that were completely undeserved. Let me just say that everything I know, basically, that's useful, I learned from Neil. And, you know, the way he talks about his career having gone down and down, well, I kind of made the decision to hitch my career to his, so, you know, I've kind of followed him down. Actually, the first time I became aware of Neil, I read an article that he'd written in Saturday Night Magazine about how the tax system favored the rich. And I was just stunned, like it was just an incredibly powerful article. And I was just stunned at the very end to read the tagline, you know, "Neil Brooks teaches tax law at Osgoode Hall Law School." I just couldn't believe that, you know, somebody so knowledgeable could be so progressive or something like that. But anyway, it's been just a terrific, terrific honor to, we've collaborated before, but to actually write a book with them. Now let me just say, this book that we've written, you know, it's, you know, about the rise of the new rich. And I should point out, there are other books out there about the rise of the new rich, but they're a little bit different. They're often sort of all about how glamorous and exciting the lives of the rich are. And amazingly, you know, even in the wake of the financial crisis in 2008, we're still getting that kind of book. You know, there's a new book out about John Paulson. You know, he's that hedge fund manager who made $3.7 billion betting against the subprime mortgage market, you know, giving him the all-time record in history for profiting from the misery of others. Because really, his bet, his trade, as they call it, helped trigger the financial crisis with all the, of course, horrible repercussions that we're all still experiencing from that. Now, you might expect a journalist writing a book about this guy would have some critical things to say. But surprisingly, this book is extremely positive. He's portrayed as a hero. You get a sense from the title. It's written by a Wall Street Journal reporter, and the title of it is The Greatest Trade Ever. But, you know, that may be the view on Wall Street and on Bay Street and places like that. But our sense is that among ordinary people, the view is probably closer to those protesters who marched down Wall Street carrying a placard saying, "Jump, you fuckers." So I guess I just want to clarify that you know, our book is more in the kind of "jump, you fuckers" genre of books about the rich. But I think Neil has given you a lot of the sense of the book, and of course he's taken up 90% of the time, because he, of course, does speak exactly for 50 minutes. He is programmed. I've noticed this exactly. But anyway, that gives me 3 or 4 minutes to add a few points. I guess I just want to, among other things, I want to point out that I think the extreme level of inequality that we see today, this you know, incredible rise of income at the top, while the rest of the population has really been stagnant, as Neil, you know, gave some numbers on that, I think that Canadians, by and large, don't really know that story. You know, essentially what's happened is all the income growth in the last 3 decades has gone to the top. It's gone to the top 10%, but it's particularly gone to the top 1%. And the higher up within that 1% you go, the bigger the economic gains are. So, for instance, 30 years ago, the average CEO typically had an income that was 20 to 30 times the average wage. Today, that gap is that the average CEO has an income that's roughly 200 to 300 times the average wage. The top hedge fund managers in the financial business, you know, the gap is even more extreme. For instance, here's one statistic that always stuns me. In 2009, like that's after the financial crash, the top 25 hedge fund managers earned on average, $1 billion each. Okay? And that, by the way, is not 200 or 300 times the average wage. That is 24,000 times the average wage. And by the way, some of these numbers are American. The case has been most extreme in the United States, but it has been very much the case here in Canada as well. In the last dozen years in Canada, for instance, while the incomes of ordinary people have been stagnant, and you may not feel that the incomes are stagnant, but you probably do feel that they're stagnant. But in case you're doubting that, don't forget that people in the middle class are basically working twice as hard as they did earlier, because of course they have two incomes, whereas 30 years ago it was not unusual to have a single family income, or one income for a family. Anyway, while this has basically been stagnant among ordinary people, in Canada in the past dozen years, the incomes of the top 50 CEOs have risen on average by 440%. Just a staggering increase at the top. And our sense, and I'm sure you got this clearly from Neil, is our sense is this is just a dramatic change. This is a dramatic change that cries out for some kind of justification. You know, you fundamentally change how money is distributed among the people in society, and nobody kind of even comments on it. And you raise it and you're considered some kind of weird radical or something. We think it absolutely cries out for justification. Now, to the extent that there is a justification out there in the business press, it tends to be that the people at the top have to have these big incentives, right? They have to have the incentives so they will perform to optimal capacity, that this is really necessary for the success of our economy. So you would think, given the huge rewards at the top, that the performance must be just staggering. I think you know where I'm going with this. Let's just give you a couple of quick, fun examples. Hank Aaron, the best baseball player in the early 70s, terrific baseball player, was making $200,000 a year, which was the top salary in baseball. Today, Alex Rodriguez is the top player in baseball. If you adjust for inflation, he's making $28 million, but I want to adjust for inflation because otherwise you might think it's just inflation. But if you adjust for inflation, Rodriguez is still making 30 times what Hank Aaron made. But there's no evidence that he's 30 times better. In fact, there's no evidence that he's better at all. And he's got steroids. And you see this kind of example, in fact, throughout sports, throughout entertainment, throughout the business world, throughout the financial world. In the 50s, for instance, General Motors, the CEO of General Motors, was making what would in today's dollars be $5 million a year. But he was presiding over one of the most successful companies in the world, highly profitable. By 2007, the CEO of General Motors was making three times what the guy had made in the 50s, but he was presiding over a company that was millions of times worse. In fact, by 2007, GM reported a $39 billion loss. And yet, the pay just kept ratcheting up. Or it's even more extreme in the financial sector. I don't know if you remember that in 2009, after the terrible financial crash, the head of Merrill Lynch gave their top executives $4 billion worth of bonuses. This is right after this top team had just steered the company to $29 billion in losses. And I think some reporter asked him, you know, why are you doing this? And he said, well, we have to do this to keep our most talented people. Which makes you wonder what some of the less talented people they had might have done. But our point is that when you look through the evidence, there's just simply no evidence of a justification for this enormous run-up at the top. Today's top earners are not more talented, they're not more creative, they're not more hardworking than the top earners were 30 years ago. They're not worth 200 or 300 times what the average income person is working. They're certainly not worth 24,000 times what the average worker is earning. In fact, we argue that there's no justification. What basically has happened is there's been simply a kind of a coup that, in effect, what's happened is, you know, this concentration of income at the top, this huge income, is the result of a, you know, massive, masterful political campaign, basically to get more for themselves. And how did they do it? Well, you know what? I'm going to throw in a list here. Okay? Well, I'm just going to quickly say that, Neil, four items I want to draw your attention to. Basically, this is our point, that it's not something haphazard. It's a deliberate campaign. And we identify, for instance, changes in CEO compensation, stock options principally, very, very key factor in driving up wages. Changes in ideology, the ideology of neoliberalism that basically encouraged the encouragement of greed and accumulation at the top and the kind of tolerance for greed in society, which was not the case 30 years ago. Changes, very crucial changes in the tax system that drove taxes down for people at the upper end. And also, fourthly, the changes that have disempowered labor, because by disempowering labor, that has empowered capital and has allowed capital to basically trample on the rights of so many working people. And so what we argue basically is that this enormous concentration of wealth at the top, it's kind of a scam, really, what's happened. And partly the reason it's a scam is because they haven't been honest. You know, the group at the top that have orchestrated this big change, it's not as if they came out and said, well, you know, we're greedy. We would like more. They don't say that. Instead, they couch it in terms of it's an economic necessity. You have to do this. You have to cut taxes on the rich. If you don't cut taxes on the rich, you will destroy the economic performance of your country. You'll gut economic growth. You'll limit economic growth. And therefore, in the interest of all of us, we have to cut taxes on the rich. That's the way they sold it to us. Well, as Neil has pointed out, next time somebody makes that argument to you, one of the things you can say is, well, after you say, go Flames, go, you know, then the next thing you say is that, in fact, high taxes, there's no evidence that high taxes actually do anything to destroy economic growth. Because, in fact, if you look at that post-war period, 1945 to 1980, the taxes on the rich, as Neil's mentioned, were incredibly high. The marginal tax rates were 80 and 90%, both in Canada and the United States. And yet, both in Canada and the United States, those were the periods of greatest economic growth in our countries. They were vibrant capitalist economies. So you cannot argue that the high taxes destroyed economic growth. It is simply refuted by the evidence. And in fact, strikingly, since the taxes have been reduced since 1980, and they have been dramatically reduced since 1980, you know, we mentioned there were marginal tax rates as high as 80 and 90 to, in fact, above 90% some years. They're now down to the top marginal tax rate is 46%. Dramatic reduction. And yet, since that's happened, economic growth has slowed down as well. So the lower taxes since 1980 have not produced the big cornucopia that we're always told about. Now, the other big argument, of course, they always come out with is that if you have high tax on the rich, they'll leave, right? They'll leave. Well, you know, I was going to say, you know, when people say that, and your point is, you know. But, you know, this is actually a huge topic, and since Neil talked so long, I don't really have the time to get into it. But let me just say, some will go. They will, and they'll be very noisy when they go. The truth is, most won't go, because most people actually make decisions in their lives for more reasons than just the rate of tax. You know, they like to live in a country because their family's here, their friends, whatever. We actually have some interesting arguments in the book about how to deal with the problem of tax havens. But, and maybe we can talk about that in the question period, but I won't get into that now. But I guess the real point I wanted to make is just simply to raise the point. It's interesting the way we just let them hold us hostage like that. I mean, imagine if another group in society, not the rich, another group, let's say plumbers, you know, or electricians or something, threatened to leave the country unless we did exactly what they wanted. You know, would we immediately kind of submit to them and just do what they wanted? I mean, it just seems a curious kind of approach that we don't think, isn't this odd that we're being demanded to do these things? And if we don't, you know, they're going to threaten to leave, and that we sort of think, well, then we better do it. I have this whole thing I want to talk about, why Bill Gates doesn't deserve his fortune. But I think maybe I don't have time. Do I have time? Or?
Yeah.
Jeez, not many Bill Gates fans here tonight. Okay. Well, all right. What I want to say then is that today's concentration of income on the top is a reflection of what we called, or what could be called, the great man theory, right? The idea that, you know, there's certain individuals who are just so talented and so much better than the rest of us that kind of all by themselves they make great things happen. And, you know, if they were to leave the country, we'd barely be able to figure out how to turn the lights on. And this notion is, therefore, you know, that because these people are so talented, they really deserve their billions. And in fact, this kind of theory is often advanced by billionaires. So for instance, here's just a couple of billionaires. Here's Leo Hendry, who invented a sports cable TV network. He said, "I think there are some people, including myself, who are, because of their uniqueness, warrant whatever the market will bear." One of the things I like about billionaires is their modesty. Or here's Sanford Vail, a big Wall Street tycoon. He says, the last 25 years is an incredibly unique period. We didn't rely on somebody else to build what we built. We did it ourselves. Really, really, really. That's an interesting thought. So in other words, if Sanford Vail had been abandoned at birth on a desert island, he would have built his fortune up, goddamn, exactly the same way that he did, right? Well, maybe not. And so the interesting thing is that, you know, we would argue that if he could build up that fortune all by himself, abandoned on a desert island, then he should be able to keep every single bit of it, because he did it all himself. But if he couldn't reproduce it all on his own, then I think it's reasonable to ask the question, how much did he create and how much did other people create? Because the great man theory always leaves out the role of society, right? It always leaves out the role of every other person in the great man's life. The people that nurtured that person, that educated him, that created the society that allowed him to thrive. And most crucially, what it leaves out is the technological inheritance from the past that enabled his breakthrough to happen. And so here we come to Bill Gates. Now, Bill Gates is credited with inventing the operating system of the personal computer. But that was only possible because of all the advances that had happened before that. In fact, the computer itself had already been invented by the time Bill Gates was born. So every advance that led to the development of the computer, and every advance before that, going all the way back to the beginning of, you know, the invention of the wheel, every advance builds on the other. And the truth is, Bill Gates could never, of course, have invented the personal computer if all those advances hadn't come before. So the notion, you know, we didn't really rely on somebody else, we did it all ourselves, it's just ludicrous. Every individual relies on thousands of individuals in society, and historically many more tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. In fact, it's been calculated that this technological inheritance is responsible for something like 90% of the wealth that's generated today. It's just an immense inheritance. So the question is, who does that inheritance belong to? Who should be the beneficiary of all that technological development from the past? Well, under our current system, Bill Gates gets virtually all the benefits from the personal computer, even though he only really was involved in the very last stage of the development. Oh, and by the way, here's another kind of cute irony. Bill Gates actually didn't invent the operating device of the personal computer. Actually, it was another guy. It was Gary Kildall. And Bill Gates knew Gary Kildall, but he managed to kind of elbow him out of the way and get the contract with IBM instead. And in fact, that kind of thing is typical, because the way science works is that one advance leads to another. And when a scientific breakthrough happens, the next stage is kind of obvious and more or less inevitable to the relatively small number of people that are working in that field. So with or without Bill Gates, we would have had the personal computer. We would have had it because of the technological inheritance from the past. So the point is, why should $53 billion be in Bill Gates' pocket rather than sharing a larger amount of that through taxation with society at large? And we have in the book a number of ideas about how we can increase the taxes. And, you know, again, when you say this kind of thing, when you talk about increasing taxes on the rich, for instance, we suggest that there should be a new top marginal tax rate for incomes above $500,000. So probably not too many people in the room are going to be affected by that. But there are a number of Canadians making over $500,000 a year, and we think they should, once they reach $500,000, income above that should be taxed at the rate of 60%. And we think that with incomes above $2.5 million, and by the way, there's about 5,000 Canadians making $2.5 million a year, 59,000 making $500,000 a year, we think anything above $2.5 million should be taxed at 70%. Now, maybe that sounds onerous, but in fact, here's the question. Since all the money has gone to the top, wouldn't that be a logical place that we should tax? If we have a choice, if we have to raise taxes on the rich, raise taxes on the rest of the population, or let government services decline because we don't have enough tax revenue, and therefore punish all the bulk of the population that relies on those programs, if we have those three choices, is raising taxes on the rich such an unreasonable one? I do want to quickly tell you one idea that we have for taxes, tax change that I think is really exciting, and I think you will find it exciting too, and that is to introduce an inheritance tax. We don't have an inheritance tax in Canada. We used to. It was quietly canceled in 1972, and we're one of the few countries in the Western world that doesn't have one. Okay, so what we propose is that inheritance is bigger. You could inherit up to $1.5 million and pay no tax at all. So only going to be the top 1% that are affected by this, okay? So think about it. You get to get $1.5 million without paying any tax, which is interesting when you think about it, because when you earn income up to $1.5 million, you pay lots of tax on it, but we're going to give you an exemption on that first $1.5 million, which is unearned income. I mean, it's due to no skill, no talent, no effort on your part, only the skill of choosing the appropriate parents. You know, I mean, Warren Buffett has called this the ovarian lottery. And I think that's a suitable... But anyway, the exciting part of this is that once we get that money from the taxing people, you know, the top 1% inheritances, there will be enough revenue that we'll be able to set up educational trust funds for every Canadian child. So when every child turns 16, they will have $16,000 deposited into an educational trust fund to be used exclusively for education or training of that child. And you know, we just and in addition to what that will do for national productivity, it will simply do wonders for the notion that this is a inclusive community, that we care about people in our community, and that we actually believe in a concept like equality of opportunity. I think I'm going to wrap up here, but I want to leave you with some good news, okay? Because, you know, sometimes this seems a little down to be thinking of how, you know, how much the rich have gotten richer and how bad Neil's career is. But this is some very good news. And that is ordinary people, not even just people in this room, but even ordinary people out there, actually care about equality to a surprising extent. And the evidence I want to point to is there's an interesting study that just came out that was done by a couple of professors at Harvard. And they interviewed thousands, something like 5,000 typical Americans, randomly selected. Rich, poor, fat, thin, Republican, Democrat, everything. And there's a couple of things. One of the things they found, that the issue they were interviewing them about was to do with inequality and distribution of wealth, okay? And the first thing they discovered is that Americans have absolutely no sense of how actually unequal their country is. They just have no sense whatsoever. And as the Harvard guys pointed out in here, even there were some economists that had been randomly selected, and they had no idea whatsoever either. So that's the first thing, that the actual level of inequality is unknown. But here's the really intriguing thing. Then the second part of the study was to determine, well, what would they like? What would Americans like to have as the level of inequality in their society? Like, how would they like the shares of the national income to be distributed among different segments of the population? And they did this in an intriguing way. They drew up sort of three, I guess you could call them pie charts, okay? And they just labeled them pie A, pie B, and pie C. Pie A was, although they didn't know this, the people doing this didn't know, like the Harvard people knew, but the ordinary people didn't know. Pi A represented the actual distribution of wealth in the United States. So very unequal, okay? Pi B represented the actual distribution of wealth in Sweden, okay? Pi C showed total equality. Well, you know what? It turned out 90% of the Americans, randomly selected, rich, poor, fat, thin, everything, selected as their preferred choice of how wealth should be distributed, Pi B, Sweden. Of course, they didn't know it was Sweden. If they'd known it was Sweden, they would have rejected it. It would be socialism, and they wouldn't have had anything to do with it. But that is the reality. 90%. Actually favored that fair a distribution of income. Now, that's an American study, but if anything, I think Canada would probably even more that way. And I do have a little bit just quickly to say about Canada. You know, there is lots of evidence that Canadians do care deeply about social programs and care about social programs more than tax cuts. Sure, if you ask them, do you want a tax cut? You know, do you want some chocolate? Do you want some ice cream? You know, they say, yeah, I do. But if you force them to choose, if you say, do you want a tax cut or do you want social reinvestment? Do you want your money spent reinvested in healthcare, education, pensions, etc.? Overwhelmingly, by margins, actually above 80%, Canadians will tell you they want social reinvestment. You know, and this is maybe a little surprising because we tend to think, you know, if you just observe what's going on out there, you tend to think from reading the media that everybody out there is suffering from tax rage. You know, it turns out, in fact, very, very few Canadians are actually suffering from tax rage. In fact, I can tell you it's really just a small group. It's rich older men. And I actually have some evidence to back this up. I'm not just making that accusation. My evidence is there's a publication that comes out in the National Post from time to time. It's a weird little publication. It's called The Wealthy Boomer, a very strange publication. It consists of just two things, articles about tax rage and ads for Viagra. You know, which leads me to wonder, you know, does tax rage cause erectile dysfunction? Or does erectile dysfunction cause tax rage? But anyway, my point is that the right is impotent. Actually, sadly, that is not true. The right is not impotent. But my real point is neither are we. And the point is that it's time that we actually started standing up and fighting to make this a more equal society. Thank you very much.
That was Linda McQuaig speaking at the Vancouver Public Library November 3rd. The event was sponsored by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives at policyalternatives.ca. For the Q&A session, a dozen questions were taken off microphone and then handled by Linda and Neil.
All right. Let's see. The first one, how do I think it was sort of like how can we affect change? that is, of course, the key question to which we, of course, have no answers. No. I mean, the truth is, you know, we have to keep pressing on these things. But let me just say that, you know, I think that it is a question. We simply have to start pushing back a lot more. I mean, one of the things I've noticed, I mean, I've been kind of around this subject for years now, and, you know, even I have noticed, like, when I'm doing interviews or something, like, it's always hard to kind of get out the line, you know, well, we should raise taxes on the rich. There's such a kind of a pall that comes over the interviewer and such a kind of horror. I mean, that is kind of a no-go zone. I think one of the things we have to do is we have to start asserting that position very clearly and very strongly and kind of without embarrassment, like almost like, well, all this money, you see, it starts from the point, you know, that since the money has become so concentrated at the top, where would you go? You know, like, the point is the money is up there. That's where the tax should logically go. And also for all the reasons that we've argued about how inequality is bad actually in itself, just simply having that concentration at the top and having such a gap between the rest of society, how damaging that is to society. We should, instead of being on the defensive about this, be on the attack, be on the offensive, that this is actually something that should be done, that this is morally correct. You know, that we have to stop kind of shrinking away from it and actually assert it as something that would make this a fairer, more equal society. And the other thing is, you know, maybe this ties in with the question, something about sustainable recovery that I just forgot to make the point. But one of the problems we have now in not having a recovery is that all the money is up there at the top. There is not enough money out there in general circulation. And as long as you have that population, you know, the general population without money in their pockets, going to spend and buy things, businesses are not interested in investing. So if nothing more, in order to stimulate economic growth, get the economy moving, we need to redistribute. We can't just have the money concentrated at the top. You know, we're in the middle right now of a corporate tax reduction. We've been reducing corporate taxes since the year 2000, and we're going to continue to reduce them to 2012, even though our corporate tax rates are already more than competitive than the corporate tax rates in the U.S. There is simply no justification for continuing to drive corporate taxes down. Corporations, you give corporations more savings, like through cutting their taxes. If there's no vibrant economy out there with people, with consumers having money to spend, they're not going to invest it. So we're just throwing that money away. Oh, the person who made the point about 1945 to 1980, we didn't have India and China to compete with. Let me just say, what we're talking about is not Canada or the United States losing ground to other countries that might be, caused by, in fact, that isn't the case, but you might be concerned with that. You might point to the rise of, what we're talking about is redistribution within Canada. So in other words, it's not that corporations are suffering because of external competition. That wouldn't explain why they're having to pay their CEOs so much more than their workers. This is an internal redistribution within the country. It has nothing to do with us losing our place in the global economy. And in fact, as I think Neil gave some numbers earlier, in fact, the truth is, if you look around the global economy, you know, the countries that actually distribute money more equally are doing extremely well. The World Economic Forum that judges global competitiveness, you know, typically Finland is number one on that index. Certainly the Scandinavian countries are almost always in the top 10 of global competitiveness. So the notion that sort of globalization has kind of changed the picture and prevented, you know, prevented us from being properly, you know, the need to be competitive, that that would require us to be more unequal. There's just no evidence to support that. The more equal countries are, if anything, doing better in terms of the global economy. Okay, there was an interesting question on tax havens, and I'm going to leave that to Neil, because Neil, you know, you tell your idea, you know. No, Neil has this terrific idea about how to deal very simply with the tax haven problems, and I'll leave it to him to tell. Let's see. And you know what? The trickle down question. We do deal with the trickle down theory. It's the trickle down theory that is actually underlies the argument that keep taxes low on high income people, and you'll have stronger economic growth. And in fact, you simply, you know, if you look at the actual evidence, you find that there isn't that trickle down. That in fact, the period when, you know, after 1980, when we've allowed, well, in, after 1980, the people at the top and the corporate sector have had much larger coffers. The people at the top, partly because they've had higher salaries and also because they've had tax reductions, and yet we've had much lower levels of growth. So I'm simply saying the trickle-down theory is a theory, but there's no evidence whatsoever to support it. And as for the HST, well, that is, it's funny, we were talking about this earlier. I was against the GST when it was introduced. I was against it as a unfair way to raise income. You know, that it's not a progressive tax, that it would be much better to raise, if we wanted to raise that money to, you know, they replaced the manufacturer sales tax and brought in the GST, but instead what they should have done was made the income tax system more progressive. You know, having said that, I would say I'm very nervous about supporting tax revolts. Like, I think the HST was a mistake to introduce it, though, you know, and I opposed it at the time. But now that we have that tax, I'm very nervous about encouraging tax revolts, because I think ultimately they end up playing into the hands of the rich. Because what the rich really want to do is fire up the population to hate taxes. Because by doing that, then, you know, they can get their own tax rates down. They don't care if government services are gutted as a result and we don't have enough money to pay for the public programs. They don't want those public programs. They've been trying to eliminate them for years or to cut them back to a very minimal level. So, you know, the HST is a very tricky subject, but I guess I would just say that, you know, we should always fight for progressive taxes. That's important. But we shouldn't encourage tax revolts, because I think they're very dangerous. Anyway, I'll pass it over to Neil.
Well, let me just, I'll just pick up a couple of really quick points. I'll only be 50 minutes here. Just really quickly, because I think, Leonard, one is, someone did, again, in terms of competing with India and other countries, I mean, the thing is, if to compete with other countries, what you want is a productive workforce. And the evidence that your workforce will be more productive if your distribution of income and wealth is more equal is overwhelming. And so that's not even an issue. Secondly, someone mentioned about the figures about 14% going to the top 1% being distorted because the wealthy have so much of their income in tax havens. That's absolutely right. One-third of the personal wealth of high-income people is held in tax havens. We don't have it. It doesn't show up in those income figures. So, in fact, the distribution of income, those numbers would suggest, is much worse than that, because the high-income folks are evading so much of their so much tax on their income. So the person who pointed that question out is absolutely right. And we do have a thing, and I think I'll leave it to the book. You can see our little description about how you should solve this problem in the book. And then, and then someone mentioned the marginal tax rates. Here's just an incidental. It is the case that the marginal tax rates, I mean, the only tax in which we have marginal tax rates is, of course, the income tax. It's the only progressive tax we've got, but it's very salient, and some people say, oh, look at that, the income tax, the rich are paying much more of their income in their tax now than low-income people because they're paying so much more income tax. But in fact, it is our only progressive tax. Poor people pay a greater percentage of their income in sales tax, in property tax, in excise tax. In fact, a wonderful study, an absolutely wonderful study that you all should look at that have done by the BC branch of the Canadian Center for Policy Alternative on, I can't remember, Fairness in Tax, the Mark Lee study. What he showed, he studied who's been paying taxes, and what he showed, now get this, if you consider all the taxes in Canada, sales taxes, excise taxes, property taxes, all of which are regressive, the bottom 10% of Canadians pay a higher percentage of their income in tax than the top one. It's absolutely remarkable. We've got a flat tax system, and everyone's paying about the same percentage. Everyone pays somewhere between 30 and 35% of their income in tax, and it's just those. But it's quite remarkable when people on the right argue we should have a flat tax system. I'm wondering, what are they talking about? We got one. We kind of like a progressive one. When you consider all the taxes, everyone pays about the same. The high-income folks are getting an incredible free ride through our tax system. Finally, I just might mention about the final comment is the someone mentioned about the HST. This is a difficult, this could be like 50 minutes, but just really briefly. I mean, we do two kinds of things with our tax system. One, we collect revenue to finance public institutions, and secondly, we use it to try to achieve a more morally acceptable distribution of income. So it's largely this second function that we're talking about. We got to tax the rich, not to raise revenue, really. Indeed, if we didn't collect any money from them, that'd be perfect. That is, if we imposed a rate on everyone who earned over $2.5 million of 70%, and we didn't collect any money, we would have achieved our objective. That is, we don't want people earning that much money, basically. And indeed, under our system, I think we calculated we'd raise about $8 billion with these two additional tax rates on these high income. It's not a lot of money, frankly. If you want to finance public institutions, here's the bad news. You got to pay for it. In Sweden, for example, which has a very highly well-developed, their GST is 25%. That is to say, in Sweden, what happened is workers said, we want economic security. You know, we want early childhood education, we want free university tuition, we want long-term care for the elderly, and we'll pay for it. That's how you get it. And indeed, people who say, oh, we can't pay any more tax, we don't want to raise the HST and things, we can't afford all this tax, I have no idea what they're talking about. We could afford a whole lot more taxes. Because everything we buy, collectively, and that we finance through democratic institutions, if we don't pay for it in our taxes and provide it to ourselves collectively, we will be paying for it ourselves through private markets or through our voluntary activities. I'm reminded of this, incidentally, every time. I'm often wonder when people say, you know, we can't afford long-term elderly care or we can't afford early childhood education. I'm thinking, what are they talking about? Do they mean we can't educate our children? Do they mean we can't look after the elderly? Turns out that's not what they mean. What they mean is we ought to structure our social institutions so that women, by and large, provide those services free or whatever. And I'm reminded of this every time I come to BC because I've got an elderly mother who lives in BC who lives on public pensions quite comfortably. And frankly, I and a lot of other people pay a lot of taxes because she draws CPP, OAS, GIS, and can live reasonably comfortably. And I'm reminded every time I visit her, I'm thankful for how much taxes I pay. Because I realize here's a cost we cannot avoid, namely taking care of the elderly. I either pay a lot of taxes, and my mom lives in dignity on public pensions, or, you know, I have my mother living with me. That's the choice. I cannot avoid that cost of looking after the elderly. And both me and my mother would rather have her living on her own and paying taxes. So the point is, the thing about the HST and those kinds of taxes, the reason we've got them is we've used them to finance. So it's quite a different issue, I guess, is what I'm saying, than sort of what our book is about. Our book is about using the tax system to achieve a more equitable society. There's quite a different debate to be had about how we should raise taxes and how much we should to finance these kinds of public goods and services that enormously enrich our lives and that we all benefit from. Anyway, you've been an absolutely wonderful crowd, and we've got lots of good comments. The next edition of the book will incorporate your comments.
That ends the question and answer period. At a presentation by Professor Neil Brooks and co-author Linda McQuaig on their new book, The Trouble with Billionaires, Why Too Much Money at the Top is Bad for Everyone. This recording was made by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org. The event at the Vancouver Public Library, November 3, 2010, was sponsored by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives at policyalternatives.ca.